On a summer evening in January 1989, Canberra Police Chief Colin Winchester arrives home. As usual, he parks in the wide concrete driveway that he shares with his neighbour.
Colin, what's the problem? Are you coming in?
A few moments later, when he hasn't come inside, Colin, his wife Gwen decides to investigate.
Oh my God, he's ill. Oh no.
Thinking he may have had a heart attack or a stroke, she rushes back to the house to call an ambulance.
Ambulance, please.
But this is no medical emergency.
Gwen Winchester.
Assistant Police Commissioner Colin Winchester has been shot dead. It will take 6 years and one of the most sophisticated and skilled forensic investigations in Australian history to bring his assassin to justice. Colin Winchester's life has been one of slow and steady achievement without any outstanding or dramatic events.
From very humble background, but he achieved very high rank. And I believe that had he lived, he would have gone on and been the Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police.
Winchester grows up in a mining town just south of Canberra and marries local girl Gwen. They have two children. At the age of 28, he decides to join the ACT Police, starting out as a general duties constable.
He came into Queanbeyan and he joined the force. Started off, he wasn't an educated man in the sense of having formal education at university.
Through the 1960s and 70s, he moves steadily up through the ranks, building a reputation for honesty and for solid, reliable leadership.
Apart from going to detective training courses, he used to undertake other courses at CIT, or what it was then called, he'd be doing courses such as accounting or I think he might have even done psychology, things like that. In a sense, it wasn't as if he was ambitious. He wanted to further himself. He wanted to know more, to learn more.
His promotions accelerate after he shines in several advanced management courses. In 1979, he's CIB chief when the ACT and Commonwealth Forces and the Customs Narcotics Bureau are merged into the Australian Federal Police. Winchester takes on various senior assignments, including officer in charge of the AFP's Southern Command in Melbourne. In 1984, after 23 years in the service, he is promoted to the rank of Assistant Commissioner before returning to Canberra in 1988. By now, he's widely recognised as an affable and humorous man, popular among his colleagues.
You know, he'd play practical jokes on you, and he'd be always laughing, always telling jokes. And barristers, the courts, the legal profession, generally, everybody in Canberra, he was well known, very well known, and very well liked. Had mates from all over the place, and from all walks of life, he was that sort of fellow. He could get on with anybody.
Even those on the wrong side of the law see him as tough but fair, a blunt-speaking, clean-skinned cop with a strong sense of duty.
Young people, normally, who I would appear in court for, he used to take them under his wing. We got them bonds, and then he would spend more time with them, and he'd help them out and make sure that they got on a straighter path. They used to come and thank him after that.
Colin Winchester has few enemies, but by 1988, there is one man in Canberra who makes the Assistant Commissioner the focal point for all his hatred. He's disgruntled former public servant, David Harold Eastman. Everyone who knows David Eastman admits he's very clever. The son of a respected senior diplomat, he's given a solid private school education and graduates from Canberra Grammar with the prestigious title of Ducks of the School. Like his father before him, he settles on a career in the public service, landing a position in Treasury. But in the years that follow, he becomes convinced he's a victim of multiple injustices. He channels his anger into relentless harassment of those he believes have wronged him or who stand in his way.
He believed there were people in the Australian Federal Public Service who were plotting against him, who were scheming against him.
He accuses fellow public servants of being involved in various rackets and corruption, and he bombards the media and politicians with his accusations.
But he would quite often contact journalists in the press gallery and with the local newspaper and television with a long litany of complaints about the public service.
Some of his claims are even raised in Parliament, but none is ever substantiated.
How dare you speak to me like I'm the criminal? You're the criminal!
At the same time, as an accomplished economist, he criticises government policy in well-crafted articles and letters to newspapers. In 1977, 31-year-old Eastman misses out on a promotion at Treasury, and in a fit of rage, he resigns. But it isn't long before he regrets the decision, and over the next 10 years, he wages a relentless campaign to re-enter the public service. Claiming to have been victimised, he makes more wild allegations about corruption within Treasury. As time passes, his frustration boils over. Over the years, he's charged with making various threats.
I'll kill you, you bastard!
He could get very angry, I'm told. I know a number of reporters who have been on the receiving end. Very serious tongue lashings over the phone and in public. I'm told by some of those reporters that threats were made against them directly. I'm told by the same reporters that they had reason to take it seriously because apparently when David Eastman made a threat, it sounded like it was very, very serious.
In December 1987, David Eastman is living in a flat in a Canberra suburb when he becomes involved in an argument with his neighbour, Andrew Russo.
Wait, the car's in the way again. Move the car.
Settle down. She forgets.
I'll get it.
Move. Relax.
Move it.
Settle
now.
Down.
I'm sick and tired of the car being there. It's now, always in
old.
The way.
She's old.
I don't care.
I'll get
she's
it moved
move the
for
car.
You. You just settle down.
Now move the car now.
No.
No, move
you
the
settle
car
down.
Now.
You settle
no,
down.
Now. Move the car.
Both men report the matter to police, and Eastman is shocked when they charge him with assault. Once again, it seems to him that he's the victim of injustice. He's convinced the police are conspiring against him, and that an assault charge will affect his chances of re-entering the public service.
Hi, it's David Eastman here.
Throughout 1988, he campaigns feverishly to have the assault charge dropped, telephoning the media and anyone in power who might be able to help.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. Yeah, they're all crooked up here.
It was very difficult to get David Eastman off the telephone once he got onto you. He could be very persuasive. He could be, so I'm told, very charming. He could keep you hooked. At the end of the day, what he wanted was you, a reporter, to understand what his case was against, first of all, the public service for booting him out the door.
All I'm trying to do is get back to work.
And secondly,
Hello?
Against the Australian Federal
Hello?
Police for refusing to go ahead with his claims that the neighbour was treating him badly.
Eastman insists on a meeting with Colin Winchester because he believes the newly appointed ACT Region Police Chief will be, as he puts it, a new broom. In December 1988, at the request of several senior politicians, Winchester agrees to meet with Eastman at police headquarters to discuss his conspiracy claims.
Mr. Eastman, good morning.
I'll shake your hand when this is sorted.
Well, why don't you take a seat and tell me all about it?
Yeah, I was attacked. I get attacked and your men charge me. I get attacked and you're bloody...
Please, calm down.
I am calm. Don't tell me to calm down. I'm perfectly calm.
Winchester listens politely to Eastman's complaints.
Well, if you are innocent, Mr. Eastman, you will have the right to defend the charges in court.
Oh, yeah? It's my word against theirs. If this goes ahead, I'll take this to the highest people in the country. I'd cause a lot of problems with you.
All right, Mr. Eastman, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll look into this matter myself and see what can be done. But I cannot make you any promises.
Well, that's better. You'd better get onto it now. It's due in court soon.
That's all right. Leave it with me. We'll see if there's anything out of order and I'll get back to you as soon as.
The meeting ends with Winchester promising Eastman to look into whether there had been any unfair bias.
Sorry, I sort my own way out.
The inquiry into Eastman's allegations against Russo went to a fairly high level for reasons that are still not clear in the Australian Federal Police and were eventually rejected.
One of the politicians who'd helped arrange the meeting contacted Eastman a few days later to tell him that the assault charge would stand. Then, on January the 9th, 1989, the day before the murder, Eastman was sent an official letter from the Federal Police. It told him that the case would proceed and he'd be required to face the charge in court in a few weeks' time. Colin and Gwen Winchester bought their neat and unpretentious suburban home in the Canberra suburb of Deakin in 1966, the year their son Peter was born. It's the night of January 10th, 1989. Colin Winchester arrives home at around 9:15. He removes the keys, opens the door, and begins to step out of the car. A single shot hits him in the back of the head, killing him instantly. Then a second shot hits him above his right ear. Inside the house, when Winchester has heard Colin's car drive up. She will later recall hearing two small cracks, but assumed children must be throwing pebbles. When Colin doesn't appear, Gwen comes out to investigate.
I want an ambulance, please. Yes, it's very urgent. My husband's having a heart attack. Gwen Winchester, please come, it's urgent.
Rushing back to the house, she calls for an ambulance. She then runs back to the car to try to revive him and sees blood. It's time to call the police.
Police? Yes, this is Gwen Winchester. Yes, I think Assistant Commissioner Winchester's been shot. Please come. 44 Deakin Street.
It was a surreal atmosphere. There were a large number of police outside the cordons, and there was an air of disbelief, of absolute incredulity that this could have happened. And people were in an absolute state of shock.
Forensic investigator Robert Barnes has been picked up by police from his Melbourne home and flown by private jet to Canberra, arriving at around 1 a.m. Winchester's stunned colleagues seal off the crime scene and search the surrounding area. Two spent bullet shells are recovered from the grass below the driver's side door, but little else is found.
I indicated that they shouldn't move anything at the scene because from the briefing they'd given me, there was very little physical evidence obvious, and we would be reliant on trace evidence, fine trace evidence. And I made the point very clearly from that first contact that they should not engage in preliminary examinations, movement of items or things of that nature.
There's no doubt in their mind that he's been murdered. It's been a callous and calculated killing.
Fighting tears, Federal Police Commissioner Peter McCauley said it was his saddest day.
I've known him as a friend and colleague for 25 years.
Colin Winchester had recently taken over as the ACT's chief law enforcer.
On Wednesday morning, January 11th, Australia awakes to the news that Assistant Federal Police Commissioner Colin Winchester has been assassinated.
I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I've bet my life. I can't believe it.
Roadblocks were quickly set up around the capital. Everything was searched.
It wasn't an undercover drug squad detective getting shot in a raid. It was the Assistant Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police who'd been assassinated in his driveway. The reaction was immediate. The reaction was nationwide.
With little detail to report other than the two shots to the head, the news media notes that this is the trademark of the mafia, and immediately speculates that this is a professional execution.
The effect on Canberra was absolutely astonishing. It was electrifying. One of the main reasons for that, of course, is that Winchester and the Australian Federal Police had been involved in looking at organised crime, the role of the Mafia and the Niigata and the other syndicates operating in the Riverina and the Griffith area. And the immediate suspicion was that the Mafia, that organised crime, had hired a professional hitman to get this top cop out of the way.
But the detectives can't see what the Mafia would have to gain by such a high-profile murder. And while all police inevitably make enemies in the criminal world, Winchester is widely respected as an honest and dutiful officer.
I mean, we just didn't believe that such a high-ranking policeman had been killed, murdered, and second, that such a wonderful guy, a really wonderful person. You wouldn't have thought he'd had an enemy in the world. I mean, you know, he must have amongst the, you know, the bad criminals who didn't come under his wing, but you wouldn't have thought he had any other enemy. And in fact, it was a very, very large funeral. They were packed outside all the way through Manuka, and the church was packed.
An hour before the funeral, and already mourners gathered, as well, with most of the country's top police together in a rare appearance, toughened security. Mr. Winchester, a 27-year veteran, was remembered as a true professional and a true friend.
The Winchester family asked Peter Crowley to read a eulogy.
A man of great courage, integrity and love. A man whom every decent person delighted to call friend. A tough, hard-working, honest, yet compassionate policeman, a dedicated enemy of crime. Thank God he is on our side.
A squad of the most senior detectives is assigned to the case. As well as trying to discover the motive for the killing, the team must also try to locate any witnesses, gather scientific evidence, and find the murder weapon. The scientific investigation centres on Robert Barnes.
This is a photograph taken on the night of the murder, showing the deceased, Mr. Winchester, in the position he was found after he'd been shot twice in the head.
I meticulously sketched the position of the deceased, the positions of blood splatter and other indicators associated with the scene. I located the cartridge cases, the spent cartridge cases, their positions. I then examined the general area around the car for evidence of footprints on the grass beside the driveway. I recorded all these things, even their absence. And in fact, when I had established the positions of the wounds, one in the back of the head and one in the right cheek, it was abundantly clear to me that the first shot must have been to the back of the head as he was attempting to egress, and he'd then fallen back into the car and sustained a second shot to the right cheek whilst he was angled diagonally across the driver's seat with his head to the left of the headrest, thus causing blood and other material to be ejected from the rear wound when the second shot impacted his face. When I looked closely at the car, I also noticed there was some blood spray internally within the car on the rear window, inner side, and also a little bit of material within the door frame of the car, that is, the ceiling of the car. It's my opinion that Mr. Winchester died almost instantaneously on impact of the first shot.
To identify the ammunition used in the murder, Barnes then searches the Assistant Commissioner's body for the all-important propellant residue that's deposited when a gun is fired at close range.
I then sampled off his face, that is the right side of his face, in concentric rings or circles moving out from the wound, and I did that because although I couldn't see whether there was gunshot residue there or not, it gave me the possibility of getting some measure of range based on gunshot residue distribution, potentially. I did the same thing from the rear wound. I got in the back of the car, having sampled from the back seat, having examined and recorded the blood splatter on the rear window, and I sampled from the back wound of Mr. Winchester's head, again in the same concentric circles, recording meticulously the diameters and positions and those sorts of things.
Barnes also establishes that Winchester himself has not recently used any firearms that might have left residue.
So I therefore sampled off his hands, both hands, which were essentially laying on his lap in a relaxed position.
Watching police officers are shocked when Barnes then has Winchester's body lifted from the car and placed upside down on a tarpaulin.
Normally these things happen in the mortuary in a hospital or some other place, but I did it because I realised from my experience that if Mr. Winchester had been conveyed to the mortuary for an examination, because of the enormous quantity of blood which would come out in transit, all the trace evidence would be washed off his face and head. So whilst in a sense it was an emotionally challenging time, it was a vital step in the recovery of trace evidence, which ultimately proved telling in showing connections to the murderer.
We'll now conduct a test firing.
Barnes is able to identify the ammunition as a cheap Korean PMC brand of supersonic bullets. These have hollow points that unfold on impact into a sharp-edged flower that cuts through the flesh. The markings on the cases reveal the murder weapon is a Ruger 10-22 self-loading carbine, a common sporting rifle.
We then set about recovering and documenting the other gunshot residue and partially burned propellant in and around the car.
Among this microscopic evidence that Barnes finds on Winchester's body and car are two particularly mysterious types of gunshot residue, which will later prove to be scientific links to the killer. One is a heavily charred particle called chopped disc residue, while the other is residue from two ammunition brands that are quite different from the PMC brand used to kill Winchester. As the scientific investigation continues, other detectives are seeking out anyone who might have seen or heard anything on the night of the murder. A team of carpet shampoo salesmen working the area is interviewed, as is a local couple who saw two cars driving erratically, but no one saw anyone acting suspiciously or carrying a rifle. A van parked across the street is searched. A woman who lives behind the Winchester house tells police she heard footsteps go down the side of her house at about the time of the murder. She heard them come back a few minutes later, a voice muttering, and then a car start and drive away. One local resident describes to police how two nights before the murder, she was walking in Lawley Street. She spotted a blue car parked near the Winchester home, and as she passed by, the driver seemed to deliberately conceal his face. Thinking this was suspicious, she tried to make a mental note of the number plate. She tells detectives she thinks the number was YPQ038. But police checks quickly establish that the car with that plate was definitely not in Lawley Street that night. From the very beginning of the investigation, the team of detectives must search for a motive, and they dig deep into Winchester's private and professional life. Detectives spend months following up various leads, including a claim that two mafia hitmen had been imported from Italy to execute Winchester. But to Robert Barnes's expert eye, the murder appears anything but professional.
The killer left two cartridge cases on the ground at the murder. Secondly, the killer put a silencer on a high-velocity rifle. Any person with any understanding of firearms understands that a silencer won't muffle a high-velocity discharge. The use of the silencer had negligible effect on quietening the high-velocity crack of that rifle. Thirdly, there are other weapons which are characteristically used in more professional killings. The other point which I think is overlooked is that having left telltales, the killer has used a weapon which ultimately was traceable. And I would suggest, in the strongest terms, that a professional would have made sure that the firing pin was altered in a way such that it was not identifiable or in any way unique, or would have used a weapon which didn't have any characteristics which were individual.
Despite extensive inquiries, no evidence is found to support any of the media's theories. But there was one man who was named almost immediately as a person of interest, and that man is David Harold Eastman. He'll soon become the central focus of police inquiries as more and more circumstantial evidence is uncovered. Detectives searching for the killer of Police Chief Colin Winchester begin to look at his recent cases. Each is examined to try to find anyone who might have wanted him dead. David Harold Eastman is just one of a long list of people who were interviewed. Two police officers call at his government housing unit on the day after the killing. With his lawyer present, Eastman is asked about his movements the night before. He tells police that he was out driving by himself in Canberra, but he can't remember where he'd been. He says he thinks he might have gone out at about 8 p.m. for a takeaway meal, returning at about 10 o'clock. What he doesn't tell police in that first interview is that at 11 o'clock, he'd visited a brothel and spent time with a prostitute. As he has no alibi, the investigators begin a more thorough investigation of his background. They quickly compile details of his various angry dealings with authorities and the many threats he's made.
Move the car now.
They particularly note one incident at police headquarters a week before the murder, when Eastman allegedly gestured towards Winchester's office, saying the police executive was corrupt and had a lot to answer for. It's barely a week after the murder when police return to question Eastman again and to make a detailed search of his home and his car.
Police executed warrants and the owner was then asked to move away from the car, and I'd already prepared and I was in disposable gloves, overalls, etc. I then opened the door and proceeded to sample from the driver's side compartment of that car. This is a view of the boot of Mr. Eastman's car, and you'll see that it was ostensibly, apparently, very tidy. However, what hadn't been tidied up was very large quantities of partially burned propellant and associated gunshot residue, which had spilled out into the carpet which lined the boot floor.
On the object in question, thus.
Barnes takes the samples from Eastman's car back to his lab for microscopic examination.
And placed in the coating unit.
That process took several years because of the large number of very fine debris which had been collected, and was undertaken to be conclusive and to be fair. I found gunshot residue within the inner cavity of the driver's side door handle, on the stalk switch of the light switch on the right-hand side of the steering column, and also on the upper surface of the right-hand side of the rear vision mirror. And all those locations are consistent with a right-handed shooter getting in the car, switching on the headlights and adjusting the rear vision mirror.
The size and number of particles is significant. It indicates that they were deposited in the car very soon after the gun was fired.
These sub-microscopic particles aren't sticky. They're simply fused particles of metals or associated elements. And so whilst they'll get caught in folds in skin, in hair, on clothing and that sort of thing, if you move your hand around, if you walk great distances, if you shake your clothes, they'll fall off. So the finding of this number of particles, which in context is a second transfer, is a very significant find and is a large number. And their size indicates they were deposited a very short time after the person who deposited them and discharged a weapon.
Barnes also finds a vital link between Eastman's car and Winchester's body. What is known as a chipped disc particle of heavily charred propellant residue matches a particle found at the crime scene.
This was a significant finding because in the hair which I had sampled from the back of Mr. Winchester at the scene, I also recovered a chopped disc, severely charred particle.
Barnes also finds charred residue from several ammunition brands other than the PMC type brand in the killing. After a series of tests, he's able to show that this residue had come out of a silencer.
When one shoots a 22, a Ruger 1022, which has got a silencer fitted, an amount of gunshot residue builds up within the silencer. So what I found was that if I fired some Sterling or Remington ammunition and then fired a series of shots with PMC, I would, in all the subsequent shots, generate a small number of Remington or Sterling partially burned propellant gunshot residue on the target. So I therefore formed the opinion that the shots fired to kill Mr. Winchester were fired from a silenced rifle. I am absolutely certain that the driver of that vehicle was in fact the person who killed Assistant Commissioner Winchester.
And there's evidence that no one but David Eastman had driven his car since the night of the murder. After the first raid on Eastman's home, the police set up a surveillance operation to track his every movement. They plant audio devices around his flat, tap his phone lines, and follow him whenever he goes out. Eastman objects loudly to what he describes as police harassment and protests repeatedly to politicians, the media, and the ombudsman. One of the objects of this intense scrutiny is the possibility that Eastman, as a key person of interest, may lead them to the murder weapon.
Immediately after the murder, the Australian Federal Police undertook a recall of Ruger 1022s for the purpose of test firing them in order to provide cartridge cases for the police ballistics examiners and if required, for more advanced examination, me to look at to see if the murder weapon could be identified. It was really done as an exclusionary step to rule out the large number of Ruger 1022s which were available at that time within Australia.
Police spend months checking gun dealers and newspaper trading ads to trace hundreds of sales of the common Ruger rifles. The breakthrough comes when they check out one sold just a few weeks before the murder by a dealer in Queanbeyan named Lewis Clarenbeek. The dealer gives detective shells that he recovered after the rifle was test fired here in this quarry. The shells from the test firing bear the same distinctive markings as the shells found at the murder scene.
And what I found was that the marks on the cases from the murder scene were sharp. I also found that the marks on the cases from the quarry were sharp, indicating to me clearly and conclusively that the number of shots fired between testing in the quarry and killing Mr. Winchester was small or none at all.
Just to make absolutely sure that they've positively identified the actual murder weapon, the police trace it to its previous owners, looking for more shells to match those found at the murder scene.
But they tracked down a previous owner who'd fired shots in a forest somewhere in Victoria years ago, and they went to that forest, that area, and actually found the bullets and the casings this man had fired years ago and were able to match them to the rifle, which helped them make their case.
Among the characteristics identified on all the shells, including the heavily corroded shells from the woodlands in Victoria, was a distinctively shaped firing pin mark, which came to be called the Naked Lady.
These cartridge cases had been buried in the ground for some years and had corroded significantly, so they exhibit a very stippled or roughened appearance. But notwithstanding that, at the same higher magnification, we see the remnants of the individual characteristic which we've described earlier as the Naked Lady. And I was able to show, again, conclusively using advanced scanning electron microscopy techniques, that the individual, well, firstly, that they had the same characteristics as a Ruger 1022, the class characteristics, and also they had the individual characteristics which I know to be present on the murder cartridge cases and the cartridge cases from the quarry. When you look at that at a higher magnification, that precise region, what you see is there is an individual characteristic, a very significant one amongst others, and that is unique, and it's caused by damage present on the firing pin, which has been impressed into the surface of the cartridge case right there.
Unfortunately, Lewis Clarenbeek can't identify the man who bought the gun, and even his description of him is vague. But he does remember that the mystery man did not want to buy the telescopic sight. Although sporting shooters use telescopic sights on their rifles, they're not needed if the target is close range. Then a Canberra gun buyer comes forward to say that he saw David Eastman at Clarenbeek's house, and a woman says she saw a blue vehicle, similar to Eastman's car, parked nearby. Other dealers come forward to claim that Eastman had bought or considered buying a number of guns, and on several of those occasions, they say he parked his car some distance away, out of sight. All these investigations are long and detailed, and the inquiry extends from months to years. The national media coverage begins to decline, and most Australians outside Canberra lose interest.
It became very hard at times for reporters like myself to get a Winchester inquiry story run in the national media. The judgment was that, well, you know, it's a Canberra story. It's something that's happening in Canberra. It doesn't really affect the rest of the country. It did, of course.
As the circumstantial evidence slowly mounts, Eastman now moves from being a person of interest to the main suspect, and the police surveillance operation becomes even more intense.
Eastman himself used to tell stories about how police patrol cars would circle his house 24 hours a day taking pictures of him, when he couldn't go out on the street without police following him, that the harassment was constant, that his telephone was bugged, and it was. His telephone was certainly bugged.
One aspect of Eastman's character revealed by the phone taps was his extraordinary tenacity and determination to pursue his objectives. The recording showed that he would sometimes make 40 or 50 calls to the same person until he got what he wanted. A coronial inquest into the murder opens in 1991. The coroner must explore every possible motive for the killing, even though it means Colin Winchester's family is forced to listen as all manner of idle gossip and rumour about him is aired in open court.
Well, it became clear round about the 14th day of the coronial that Eastman was the only real suspect and it was my belief that even then there was sufficient evidence for a prima facie case to be established to put him on trial, and that I took the view on instructions from the family that why should the family suffer the indignity of all these other spurious allegations, which would have an opportunity to besmirch the good reputation of the Assistant Commissioner.
It was an incredible drain on the Winchester family, but they were a very strong, close-knit family. Gwen Winchester was a very strong woman. They took it. A lot of people wouldn't have been able to.
As national media interest in the inquest continues to wane, the general public is mostly unaware of the case building against Eastman, especially much of the detail of the scientific evidence.
Mr. Robert Barnes was a foremost expert in forensic investigations, particularly of gunshot killings, and he was used throughout. His evidence was remarkable, absolutely remarkable, and believable.
The inquest ends with an open finding. However, the coroner makes a point of dismissing the various suggestions of criminal conspiracies or that Winchester may have been corrupt.
It was clear that there was some lengthy cross-examination of people that made allegations of corruption, and they were exposed as charlatans.
Although it was an open finding, he did remark at some length, in which he cleared Colin Winchester of any suggestion of corruption.
Not long after the inquest ends, Eastman is arrested and charged with Winchester's murder.
Outrageous framer, completely innocent.
But the case against him, while strong, is still dominated by circumstantial evidence. It has taken more than 5 years of intensive investigation into Colin Winchester's murder before David Eastman is finally charged. Detailed forensic examinations have been combined with tens of thousands of hours of old-fashioned detective work, with all its frustrations and dead ends. Theories of mafia hits and personal vendettas are all followed up, and nothing is found. In the end, everything seems to point to one man, but he's not about to go down without a fight. The trial begins in the ACT Supreme Court on May 2nd, 1995, and his performance in court becomes the stuff of legend. He repeatedly sacks his lawyers, insults and abuses the judge, and at one point even hurls a jug of water across the courtroom. But Justice Kenneth Carruthers is not intimidated by Eastman's offensive antics, and he refuses to allow him to sidetrack the proceedings.
He used to take great delight in sitting in court, and when his defense attorneys handed him documents to support his case, he'd tear them up in their face, throw the papers up in the air and tell them they were all sacked. And then a few days later, rehire them again.
Gradually, the Crown presents its case against David Eastman. The motive is alleged to be a long-smouldering hatred of police, with the final straw being Eastman's failure to get Winchester to agree with his conspiracy theories.
You'd be upset too if there was a bloody conspiracy against you.
The prosecutor details all the forensic evidence and the witness sightings. Among the most damning evidence is Barnes's ability to match propellant residue from the murder scene with that found in Eastman's car. Other allegations include one that Eastman had been seen looking at Winchester's car in the parking garage at the ACT police headquarters. And then there were the surveillance tapes recorded from intercepts on Eastman's phone and listening devices in his home. Police and audio experts had listened to thousands of hours of tape recordings to extract the few excerpts used in the trial. The prosecution alleges that one tape contains the words, quote, "He was the first man I ever killed. It was a beautiful feeling, one of the most beautiful feelings you've ever known." At another point, they allege Eastman is recorded as saying, "I had to go back again the next night to kill him, poor bugger." Justice Carruthers tells jurors that if they accept that the tapes contain an admission that Eastman had killed Winchester, then those tapes are direct evidence pointing to his guilt. The prosecutor, Michael Adams QC, completes the Crown's case with a devastating summation. He says that if Eastman is innocent, then there's an extraordinary number of coincidences, including the death threats, forensic evidence, and his purchase of weapons. There's also the sighting of the suspicious car, similar to Eastman's, seen near the victim's home 2 days before the murder. Eastman's number plate is YMP028, and the witness had remembered YPQ038. Although at that time the letter Y starts all ACT registration numbers, three of the remaining five numbers or letters match, and in a similar order. Mr. Adams also points out that although Winchester's name and address was not on the main electoral roll, as he had only recently returned to Canberra from assignment in Melbourne, his address was listed on the register of newly enrolled voters. Eastman had visited the electoral office and inspected that exact register sometime before the murder. In his defence, Eastman denies all the allegations and says the residues could be from the guns he bought because he was afraid of his neighbour. He also disagrees with the prosecution's interpretations of the surveillance recordings. But the jury returns a unanimous verdict of guilty. And in November 1995, David Eastman is sentenced to life in prison.
Colin's good name has survived an intense examination by the media and others. It is a sad indictment of the society in which we all live that the truth is far too often replaced by sensational fiction. Finally, Colin can rest in peace, knowing that the creaking wheels of justice will incarcerate his assassin.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
It has been a sensational trial, said to have cost taxpayers $8 million.
In the years that follow, he lodges a long series of appeals and legal challenges, and he continues to protest his innocence.
I've formed a considered opinion, and it's this, that the work of the ACT police, particularly those responsible for this investigation, is second to none. Their work in realising that it was a complex crime scene at the very outset and seeking external scientific assistance in its processing, their preparedness to listen to scientific evidence and act upon it in the seizure and sampling from Mr. Eastman's car, their willingness to ensure that no stone was unturned in having the scientific evidence explored to its full extent shows a foresight not often seen in police forces. In my view, this was one of the best police investigations of modern times.
Assistant Commissioner Colin Winchester was asked to pay the highest price required of him, his life. He would have been prepared to die for his job. He would not have been prepared to forfeit his good name. His memory deserves to be upheld and remembered with pride as an inspiration to enemies of crime.